From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It would be understandable if Jed Abumrad rested on his laurels for a while. The program he helped create, Radiolab, is the best thing in radio these days. If you've heard it, you know what I mean. Ira Glass said that Jad and his co-host Robert Krulwich have created the rarest thing you can create in any medium, an actual bona fide new aesthetic. But all of that success has created a problem for Jad. How do you make it better? He says the thing that made the show work was the fact that it didn't for a while. Failure and being willing to make mistakes helped create the program. But what now? Today on the program, Jed Abumrad is joining us to talk about change, about taking risks and being prepared, as he says, to suck for a while. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So you would think that Jed Abumrad would be the happiest guy in radio right now. He has the best program there is out there, Radiolab, and he was just awarded with a MacArthur Foundation grant, sometimes called the Genius Prize. But Jed has a conflicted relationship with his show, and it's not unlike the feeling a lot of artists have with their work when it becomes successful. It's that feeling of, what do I do now? It's the question of how you keep the quality high or how you make it even better. Jed once said the central problem for Radiolab was that the show eats him alive. And how, he asks, do I get out from under it just enough to reimagine it? Jed Abumrad has said that the thing that made the show work was the fact that it didn't for a while. He learned from all the mistakes they made along the way. But what happens once you've figured it out? Today in the program, Jed Abumrad is joining us to talk about change, about taking risk and being prepared to fail. Jed Abumrad is the creator, the co-host, the producer of Radiolab. A few weeks ago, as I said, he received a MacArthur Fellowship, also known as the Genius Award. And he's joining us today from Radiolab Studio in New York City. And Jed Abumrad, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Doug. I'm super happy to be here.
So I wanted to talk today, as I said, not about what a genius you are, though congratulations.
I could kill the mystique in 30 seconds, trust me.
It's got to be strange, though. I mean, it's called the Genius Award, and you won it, but and now that you're somehow thought of as officially a genius or something?
Well, you know, here I take umbrage in the fact that, I mean, it's completely surreal, Doug. I just have to say that. Like, I'm just now getting through the Twilight Zone phase where I'm kind of coming to grips with, like, wow, what an honor.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, I take umbrage in the fact that the packet that the MacArthur folks sent me, nowhere in it is the word genius. I think that's it's talked about as a genius grant, but it actually isn't how they think of it, and it's certainly not how I think of myself. I think of myself pretty much as the opposite, as a kind of a professionally appointed idiot. You know, I mean, I think it's my job actually to not know what I'm doing in some sense.
Yeah.
So I try to sort of laugh at the word and not get terrified by it.
Well, I was interested in something that you seem to be giving a lot of thought to lately, and that is this idea of change in the, you know, in the creative process, why it's so important, you know, and why it's so hard. I mean, this seems to have been on your mind a lot lately.
Yeah. I mean, I was, I think you set it up well in your introduction. I mean, like for the show that I make, Radiolab, which has been around now, for 9 years or 8 years. It's talked about as like the new kid on the block.
Yeah.
And in some sense it is measured in public radio years when, like, you know, shows are typically on the air for 30, 40 years.
Sure.
Not typically, I should say, but they're often on the air that long. You know, for us, this was a show that the intent was, I don't know that the intent was ever even to make a show. It was just, let's just make some new sounds. Let's try some new things. And somewhere along the way, after a series of almost an infinite series of missteps and failures, we arrived at this thing that we all call Radiolab, which has a sound, and we can all talk about it intelligently, and we're all very proud of it. But then there's that sort of question, which I think is a very old, very sort of ordinary question, which is, how do you then get back to that beginner's mind, which you had when no one was listening?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not like a gazillion people are listening, but enough are listening that you could very easily get trapped in some idea of yourself. And so, You know, it's a big question for us right now, because I feel like it's a question that's posed more urgently for a show like ours, when the expectation is that when you turn on Radiolab, you're going to hear something that you don't expect.
Right.
But if you hear what sounds like Radiolab, then suddenly that becomes, we're letting our listeners down in some sense.
Yeah, because that's what you expect.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, you gave the speech at a gathering of public radio types a few weeks ago, the managers and program directors, and you talked about the importance of change in public radio. And mm-hmm. I kind of wanted to talk about that and expand the idea, you know, beyond public radio, because I think it applies to a lot of areas, you know, art and technology, I think even science in some ways. One thing that was interesting that you talked about, though, is you had sort of started the talk with this hunch, it seems you had. And you say you hear people in public radio, and I'm sure this happens in other places, but we talk about change all the time.
Yeah.
Like, that's all we talk about. But but this idea is – but the actual part about actually changing is incredibly hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, it's, you know, it's funny. The talk you're referring to, I began that talk. I was giving the talk at the PRPD, which in you and I's business is this conference that happens every year where all of the different station directors from around the country get together to basically talk about how are we doing, what could we be doing better. And invariably you have these panels and various things about, like, how can we do this better? How can we get younger? How can we get more diverse? Mm-hmm. All of these things. And I began the talk by saying, like, I looked at the last 10 years of panel discussions that we've had in public radio, and the word change happens 74 times in those you know, the headlines for those panels. And so at the same time, you know, you look at our schedules, and I would argue that we're not changing enough. The same shows are staying around. Although on the other hand, you could argue that that's exactly why we're good, but sort of, I won't get into that. But what I was talking to the PRPD folks about was that there is a disconnect in some sense between the thing that we always talk about and the thing that we then do not follow up on and don't actually do. And there's a huge, huge tradition of psychology research which addresses this and has found very simply that the more you talk about change, the less you actually are going to do it.
Right.
You know,
right.
I'll give you a sort of a contemporary example of that, which is, I think this goes back just a few years. A guy at NYU named Peter Gollwitzer, a psychologist, did a study where he got a bunch of law students together, I think 100-something law students, and these are all highly committed students. They all want to be lawyers. And he had half of them say that out loud to the researchers. I want to be a lawyer. Yeah. I'm going to do this.
Right.
And then the researchers kind of nod and say, okay, you go. And then he had the other half basically write it silently on a piece of paper. I want to be a lawyer. And then they were not acknowledged. They were not, that piece of paper wasn't read. And it was just thrown in the trash.
They didn't say it out loud.
No, they did not.
Right.
They did not say it out loud. So then he gave them all a task that would get them closer to this goal. I forget exactly the nature of the task, but it was something that would help them to be a lawyer. And what he found was that the people who didn't talk about it, who didn't say it out loud, who were not acknowledged, worked the entire 45 minutes, whereas the people who did talk about it worked about 30. So they worked about 15 minutes less, and then basically thought, okay, I'm done. Whereas when they interviewed later the people who didn't talk about it, they said, I'm nowhere near done. I have so much farther to go. And so there's something that happens in all of us, it seems, when we talk about the things we're going to do. It creates a little bit of a good feeling that creates a sort of symbolic sense of change. And it feels good to imagine yourself as the kind of person that's going to change. Change itself doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
You know, and so there is a danger.
You said this. You said this at the... in that talk, you said that that you have to rob yourself of the inadvertent good feeling that you get by talking about it. And you say, and that's a crappy feeling.
It's a crappy feeling.
Right.
Yeah, it doesn't feel great. I mean, you know, you look at, you look in biology, you know, any change of state, you know, these little molecules that are undergoing state changes, they get very agitated, they vibrate, they jostle all around. They're unhappy, you know. It's not a good thing, but it is what makes life, you know, happen. And so that kind of feeling. I mean, if I was trying to say anything in my talk, and again, I'm not one to preach. You know, I was just talking from my own experience. But what I was saying to the people listening was that you can see that feeling, that crappy feeling you get when you're in the middle of a life change. You can see that as a bad thing,
yeah,
and something that needs to end. Or you can see it as an invitation. You know, like, okay, I feel crappy, therefore I'm doing my job, therefore I'm where I should be. And it's a subtle shift, it's a reframing that can make all the difference in the world. And it has for me, because, you know, every story we tell, Doug, you go through a period of despair where you're like, this story sucks. No one's going to listen to this story. I can't figure out the right structure. I can't figure out what sounds to put in. You know, I can't get the edit to do what it's supposed to do. And you can see that as a terrible thing and beat yourself up, or you can see that as, oh, this is just part of the process. This is what I have to go through in order to get to the other side.
You know, it made me wonder about the biology of people who are creative, who do work like you do. I mean, if our body is not sending us endorphins of pleasure, why do we keep pushing? I mean, doesn't it seem to go against this idea of biology? I mean, it makes you kind of wonder why anything really great and creative ever gets made in the first place if you have this, which I want to talk about, this gut churn, as you've talked mm-hmm. about, and this crappy feeling. Like, mm-hmm. are creative people biologically flawed? They have a mutant gene somewhere.
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know if I'm going to touch the genetics of creativity.
But, good, okay.
But I will say, I mean, it's kind of a tension, you know?
Yeah.
Like, on some basic level, a body wants to be comfortable. You know, it wants to be comfortable that the next moment is something that is known, and that the next moment after that is known, and that the next moment after that is known. I mean, that's what a brain does. It's constantly assessing the next moment. On the other hand, I mean, I read somewhere that there's a cave somewhere in the Southwest it's not a cave, it's a mountain, where there was a hole that went down through the mountain and into a cave. It was sort of like a, I don't know what you would call that, like a precipice of some kind.
Yeah.
And what they discovered at the bottom of this precipice was a collection of bones, mostly of young men, you know, I think thousands of years old,
sure.
You know. These were people who just walked a little bit too close because they were curious, you know. And there is the human instinct for novelty, there is the human instinct for adventure, and for what would happen if I got a little bit too close? You know, that is also hardwired in us in some sense. You
yeah.
know, like there's you look at baboons and like you see that there's a certain point at which I don't want to focus on men here, but it just happens to be with adolescent males. There's a certain point at which they leave their troop because another troop will pass by on the other side of the river, and they get very, very curious, and they walk up a little closer to the river each day. They get chased back, and then they walk a little bit closer until they're not chased back, and then eventually they cross, and they join that new troop. And it is, people have hypothesized, this human, it's a primate hardwiring so that we don't inbreed.
Yeah,
this is like a basis for, you know, for us spreading our population. So it could be deeply wound within our primate DNA is both a need for stasis, but also a need for novelty. And we are the tension between those two things,
yeah.
I think. You know, we are literally the pull. And so I don't know that it's a pull that will ever resolve. It's maybe just one we manage, you know?
So you're asking yourself now these questions about, okay, how do we keep it so it keeps working? I mean, how do we make it relevant? And you've talked about this conversation. You had this conversation with a guy named Mark Russell. He's the director of the Public Theater in New York.
Yeah, yeah.
That seemed really important because he talks about how this works in theater, how he thinks about it. And that seems to have given you some insights into all of this.
Yeah, Mark Russell said something to me that really sort of stuck in my head. You know, theater... Maybe there's an analogy to draw between radio and theater, because both of them. I think that radio is very vibrant, and I think there are a lot of people who rely on radio every single day. So there's some differences, but in the theater, I think it's a real question. Like, why would anyone go to the theater right now when you have movies, when you have a million things you could watch in a second on your computer? Like, why would Why would you go to the theater? And I think you can ask the same question about radio. Why would anyone listen to the radio when you could watch TV or you could go to the internet? Or now there are, I literally could entertain myself for days just with my iPhone.
Right.
You know, like, it's a real question. And so what he put to me is that when he's choosing new work for the public theater, he does it with one question in mind always, which is, why theater now?
Right.
Every single choice he makes is an effort to answer that one simple question. So every curatorial decision is based on, is this show answering that question in some sense? Or is it helping me think differently about that question? And I wondered out loud whether we in radio have enough radio that is answering that question. You know, I don't know the answer to that, frankly, Doug. I'm not saying we do or we don't, but I'm wondering if I'm asking the question because I think it's an interesting question to ask as we move forward.
Well, to me, that seems the point is the question. You know, what and it seems like one of those dynamics that seems to come into place in all kinds of successful ventures, you know, great art or great film or great radio. It's that it seems like it's that you're not satisfied with it. You don't feel, you know, there's not a complacency that there's that sense that isn't working, even if you kind of know that it is and you know lots of people are listening.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't ever feel completely satisfied with it. And it kind of makes you wonder if you is that even sustainable as a creative person, if you're never completely happy with it? Which, and I'm going to guess that the show, even though you're very proud of it, you probably wince from time to time listening to it,
you know,
right?
More than from time to time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, every show we make has one or two moments I'm deeply proud of, and it has 20 or 30 moments I go, oh, wow, you know, and I don't know. I mean, it's dispositionally, it's hard for me to sort of say why it works that way for me. I think it's just, you know, I mean, you know, if you're running a sensible operation, you figure out a way to make something where you understand the difference. Emotionally, you understand the difference between the guy that you are on the radio and the guy that you are in person.
Yeah, yeah.
On some level, I could pretend to understand that difference, you know. But really, when it comes down to it, everything is personal to me. You know, every story that we tell, we all pour ourselves into it in a really deep way. Maybe not a healthy way, I don't know. But so, you know, when you hear it back and it doesn't sound like you sound to yourself or doesn't feel like you feel to yourself, it does hurt a little tiny bit. At the same time, you understand that, like, those winces are, they become ordinary because you know, like,
yeah.
Oh yeah, this is just what happens when I hear my own voice. And so I sort of laugh at that inside my own psyche at this point. I'm like, ha ha, you're doing that thing again. But I don't know.
You know, you've talked about when you were producing Radiolab in the earliest days, and it's kind of in its earliest incarnation, which is not at all what it is now. But in those earliest days, you've talked about how it seemed like it was life or death. You described there was this kind of radical uncertainty that came to you. And I'm wondering if you – I wanted you to kind of talk about that, but also if it worries you that you don't feel that way, or do you feel that way, and do you miss that terror? I think you described it as genuine terror.
I sound like – I'm starting to worry that I'm sounding way too dysfunctional right now. Yeah, you know, it's at the very, very beginning, I was so brand new. No one was listening, really no one. I think probably like – objectively, there was zero people listening because it was on the AM on Sunday nights, and they had to kill the power to avoid interfering with other stations. So you really couldn't get the signal.
Yeah,
you know. So I don't know why it felt like life or death, Doug, but it just did. You know, it felt like my life was on the line. Every show, I had to put out something beautiful,
right,
that literally my own mother would hear and no one else. But I'm not quite sure why that was. You know. I think it was an uncertainty. It was a sense of, like, I just don't know who I am right now. I don't know very basic questions like what do I sound like? You know, like just I think back to that, and like there was the NPR sound where you talk in a very kind of, you know, stentorian kind of way.
Yeah.
And then there was Ira Glass, who was, you know, smacking his lips a lot and being very personal. And I loved Ira, like deeply loved Ira, but I didn't want to be Ira because that would be like, you know, that would be, you could be dismissed in a second. So I was stranded in this middle ground, like, what do I sound like? What how do I speak to people? You know, and then you start to think like, if this were a room, are they on the couch next to me? Or are they across a table? Is it formal? Like, you know, you start to kind of get really sort of wound up in your own, you know, negative fantasies. But I just ran into a fugue state. What was your question?
No. Well, I mean, that was whether you missed that. I mean,
oh, whether I missed it. Yeah.
Because, I mean, the thing to me, it seems that was the thing that eventually made that program work was that fear. I mean, that seems like that part of fear, that sense of failure is so essential to the creative process.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I could play you some really like it would bring tears of embarrassment to your eyes. I mean, some of the early stuff. I mean, maybe everybody can do that, but I could play you hours and hours of it. But so whether I miss that now, I mean, you know, I miss the neglect a little bit. Like I miss that sense of like you can just disappear and do something. I hated the neglect at that time, but I miss those moments where you could just try something and it doesn't work. I mean, I'll give you an example. We did a recent podcast, which was it was based on the highly important question of where in the world does tic-tac-toe not exist?
Yeah.
Like, might there be a place somewhere in the world where no one's heard of this game?
Right.
So we did a 12-minute thing on this, and it was really fun for us, and it was a complete experiment. We just did it on a lark, and we put it out there, and it was just an out-and-out rebellion. Like, we got hundreds of negative comments and hundreds of negative emails, and people thought, no, this is not what you do. You do not do this. You do science. You do big ideas. And so it was this like it was this real pushback, and I miss the days when we could just do stupid things and then walk away from it and be like, yeah, that was dumb. On to the next thing.
Yeah.
So there is a way in which you kind of have to ignore your failures now, because you have to keep failing and you have to keep experimenting and doing things that are a little bit outside yourself, which means they might be outside of your own skills, and they might be really bad. And so it's a little harder to be bad right now, but we're still dedicated to trying to be bad in ways that might inform us to then later be good.
Jad Abumrad is with us. He's co-host and producer of Radiolab. Last month, he received a MacArthur Fellowship. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last month, Jad Abumrad, co-creator of Radiolab, was awarded with a MacArthur Foundation grant, and it's giving us an excuse to talk to him about a number of things, in particular the idea of change and why it's so hard. He's joining us from Radiolab's studio in New York City. And Jad, we were talking earlier about you talk about the fact that, you know, there was a lot that didn't quite work in the early days of Radiolab. And
yeah.
I mean, you had played, I hadn't heard this one, but 20 minutes of a sound essay from Lisbon?
Yeah, it was not in the Hall of Glory moment.
Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, happy 10th anniversary.
No, thanks.
That's a great accomplishment. But yeah, back when the show was a wee little baby, and it was a 3-hour block on Sunday nights, and it was just me, and my mission was to sort of play great stories and documentaries, and I would always come up short in terms of programming, and I'd have like 2.5 hours, 2 and 45 minutes, and the show was on at 8, and it would be 6, and literally I'd be like, what am I gonna do for this 20 minutes?
Wow.
I wouldn't have any clue. And it's at that point that you reach into the bin of CDs that you had discarded and pull out something like a sound montage of Lisbon, which is just somebody standing in Lisbon on a street corner with the mic, and that's it. Yeah. And like you hear footsteps, you hear cars, which could be anywhere in the world. You hear people speaking in what might be Portuguese, but they're not even close enough to hear. And it goes on and on for 20 minutes. And there's a whole kind of community of sound artists who do that kind of work.
Sure.
That, you know, on in a different mode I might actually enjoy. But on the radio, I mean, it was like I had no other choice. And so there would be long stretches of just miserably boring radio that that I presided over because I just had no choice.
But there was a point then when, as you're trying to figure out what is the sound, what is the aesthetic we're trying to go for, there was this moment that you've talked about, and I wanted to play this clip. You had developed these, what you call these sonic IDs.
Yeah.
Something that you had heard from the radio producer, Jay Allison, that he had done. And you decided that you wanted to create something like that, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, Jay runs a station out in, is it Cape Cod?
Yeah, Woods Hole, I think.
Yeah, Woods Hole, right. Yeah. And he started this brand new station, and he you know, there's always a question, like, when you make something new, it's like you want it to have an identity. And he kind of clued into, like, well, here's how I'm going to do that. I'm going to have these little 30-second, minute-long sonic IDs where you hear a person talking about something, almost like you parachute into the life of a person on the other side of the radio, and you hear their experience for a minute. And you'll we'll pepper that throughout the day, and that will be like, that'll be like the furniture. That'll be the thing that gives the room that we're building some character. Because we'll both populate it with the people we're talking to. And that made so much sense. And I remember having a moment where we were struggling, like, well, what are we doing? Like, what is Radiolab? Like, why would anyone listen to this? And I just looked at what Jay was doing, and I was like, I want to steal that. I want to do something that's that for us. And I came up with, you know, I think I stayed up all night with a producer that I still work with, Ellen Horn, and we just had all of the sounds of radio static and various noises that we'd collected from I forget where, and we stayed up all night editing them into these little 20 or 30 second things that became how we start every show and how we still start every show.
Okay. You're listening to Radio Lab on New York Public Radio.
Public Radio,
WNYC.
Sentence one.
You're listening to Radio Lab. On New York Public Radio.
WNYC.
Wait, what? What?
Keep listening. Okay.
That's the intro. This was from your speech. I wanted to pull this up. So I guess the question was, what was so important about that? I mean, like, what about that? Was it just that the sound had a kind of dynamic quality to it? I mean, what was the thing?
It's hard for me to really talk about except to be sort of in abstractions. I mean, the way that I think about it now is that you know, we were sort of like, it's like wandering through this forest, this dark forest, and you can't really see anything. And then suddenly like a little arrow lights up, like a little marquee arrow. It's like, this way, go this way. And hearing those was like a little pointing arrow lighting up in the darkness for us. Like, we're like, oh, I don't really know why that's good. I mean, it sounds kind of quaint to me now, but it seems interesting somehow. Let's follow it. Let's just go there. Yeah. You know, I don't really know where there is, but let's just follow it. And that was the experience with the sonic ideas and with a few other moments in the show's evolution. It was just like you do something, you don't know, you don't really have an idea behind it, but you're just trying something. And then you hear it a day later or a week later, and you recognize that, oh, there's something in what you just did that works. I can't really explain it to myself yet, but I'm just going to follow it and let's see what happens. And, you know, the way that I think about it, it's like, you know, Bertrand Russell, the famous mathematician, had this phrase which sticks in my head forever, which is that the difference between explaining something to someone and having them experience it themselves is like this Grand Canyon-sized gulf,
yeah.
You know, between explanation and experience. And it was one of those moments where it was experientially embodying something that I could not explain to myself. So suddenly I had an experience that made sense to me. I was like, oh, that just feels right. I can't really tell you why, but it feels like something that I want to be. I want to be more of that. And so you just follow the experience. And it's a different kind of information. It's not an information that you can really sort of like boil into a pithy phrase. It just felt like I had leaped the chasm somehow, and I was on the other side, and I didn't know where the other side was, but here I was, you know, here I am. Let's just keep going.
Yeah, but I think the thing that sounds so frightening about that is, so how do you plan for it? I mean, if these things don't come fully formed and you have to just sort of experience it, I guess you just have to pay attention because there's no way you can map it out almost.
Yeah, you captured it in two words. I think you have to pay attention. Yeah. And you have to, I mean, what I do now when we can is, I mean, I firmly believe now, Doug, that that change is not something that can be planned. It's something that can only be recognized,
right.
You know. And what we do now is we just do a bunch of little experiments, you know. Don't overthink it. You're like, okay, let's, you know, what would happen if we were a sports show? Well, let's just pretend. Why not? I love sports. You know, there's not a whole lot of sports coverage on public radio. So let's just pretend for a second we're going to be a sports show. So we ran out and we made a show about sports. Didn't overthink it that much. Listeners weren't particularly happy. But we just tried it out. And then you step back from it, you know, a week or a month later, and you look at it and you say, well, A, B, and C didn't work so well. But D, there was something going on with D.
Hmm.
So let's just forget the things that didn't work. And then let's take the thing forward that does. You know, I mean, for me personally, we spent the first half hour talking about all the terror and the self-criticism. You know, I can tune in my own failures like nobody's business.
Right.
Like I know when I fail. But the harder part is recognizing when you've actually succeeded.
Yeah.
And the real lesson for me is that, like, you're actually succeeding all the time. You're just not seeing it. So if you build into your process a moment where you can step out of the process and look at yourself and say, oh, that worked out. That wasn't bad.
Hmm.
You know, building in a that wasn't bad recognition time has been very important to us.
Well, okay, so explain then. So you've talked about this, how 2004, you finally figure, all right, we're a show now. And you go, you start producing this program, start presenting it. And you've talked about the reaction to it. Annoying, overproduced, esoteric, infantile.
Yeah.
I mean, those terrible things. And you've talked about how you reacted to that, how it was kind of like being hit in the gut.
Yeah, it was.
And so, but here's the question, though. So how did you react to that? Do you feel like you had to, no, I know this is right. I can't respond to those. I mean, there is the point when you listen to criticism, it's really critical, but there is the point when you kind of have to stand your ground. So what was this point for you?
Yeah, you know, I wish I could sit here and tell you that I didn't listen to those criticisms and that I had the sort of strength of belief to say, no, I'm just going to keep going.
Right.
But I didn't. I remember very, very, like I can taste the air of this memory. I was sitting, so here's sort of the boring backstory, but like, you know, we came out on the air, we aired five in a row. Unfortunately, it was preempting one of the more popular shows on our station, which was Fresh Air.
Right.
So you had a bunch of people from Terrytown who were like, where is Terry?
Yeah.
Who are these jackasses on the radio? Like, where's Terry Gross? And, you know, to be honest, between you and me right now, I probably would have been among the complainers. Because if you're used to hearing one of the greatest interviewers of our generation every 3 o'clock on Friday, you know, every 3 o'clock on a weekday, and then here are these two guys talking about the esoterics of time and space. Like, what?
Right.
Like, what the hell are they talking about?
Right.
Get them away. You know, I probably would have had that reaction too. But I remember we came on the air. We got initially some good emails. And so I was feeling good. And then 5 or 6 days later, the listener services department sent us the Excel spreadsheet, which logged every call that had come in from a happy, angry or ambivalent listener. And it was pages and pages and pages of vitriol. It was a tornado of knives. It was unbelievable. And I sat there reading this. You know, some of them were just like, where is Terry? Most of them were, where is Terry? And who the hell are these two guys?
Yeah.
And I remember just feeling like I was just spinning through space at that point. It was a really hard moment. I think it's a moment everybody deals with when you're trying to make something new. But I would have probably thrown in the towel, to be totally honest with you. But I happened to be really fortunate, and then I had a guy who I was working for, Dean Capello, who's the creative you know, guru of the station, really, who basically just said to me, he was like, "Yeah, they're pissed off. All that means is that you're just doing your job." And I remember, I'll never forget that. Initially, I was just like, "Shut up, Dean. That's ridiculous." Yeah. But now I understand what he meant. It's like, if you look at the way in which new things come into the world, there's always this period of pushback. And if you understand that you're just on the path, and the path includes people hurling things at you, then you realize you're in the right direction. You know, you're going in the right mode. So I think about that now, and there was a great deal of wisdom in that. Like, yeah, people are angry, but you know what? They're always angry. And sometimes they're angry with good cause. Sometimes they're angry just because that's what happens when you change what they're used to. Mm. And yeah.
There's a you've talked about this designer, Stefan Sagmeister, who seems to have kind of figured out, at least for him, the way of kind of reimagining his life. Or when he figures it out, what is it? Every 6 or 7 years, he kind of he starts again.
He just he shuts it down. You know, he's an amazing designer, and has designed some truly iconic things, like Rolling Stones album cover, some pieces that were the Darwin chair. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Darwin chair, but he's done some incredible work. He's recognized as being one of the most sort of innovative guys in visual design. Every 6 years, I think it is, he decides to just shut down his operations. I think he works here in New York. I'm not quite sure. And he will then fly to some far-flung spot on the globe and immerse himself in something that he has no prior experience in. I think at one point he was in Indonesia for a year studying some kind of weaving or some kind of indigenous art. And for that year, that's all he does. He turns down all work. At one point, while he was in Indonesia, President Obama, who was then running for president, called him, wanting him to design his campaign posters, you know, which is, I mean, that's the call you, as a designer, you wait for your whole life.
Right.
And he turned him down. Yeah. He's like, no, I take this seriously. I take my inspiration seriously. So I'm gonna commit for a year where I don't do any work except be in Indonesia. And then he comes back. And he starts designing again. And each time he starts designing again, as you can imagine, he does it almost with a completely new aesthetic. So he has figured out a way to write into his life these disruptive moments where he blows himself up and then rebuilds himself and then blows himself up and rebuilds himself. I find that really inspiring. I mean, I can't do that. I don't think, you probably can't do that because you'd come back and they wouldn't have a job for you.
Yeah.
So it's particular to his world that he's able to do that. But I like the approach, and there's something I think about a lot, like how can I mentally do what he's doing? How can I mentally travel to some place where and then immerse myself in something so that I see myself from the outside again and then come back in a new form? Mm. I don't have the solution or the answer to that question, but it's something that I'm asking myself right now. How can I do what Stephen does but differently?
But is there ever a moment, because you've talked about how sometimes you feel trapped by this thing that you've created. So is there ever a moment when you think, okay, you know, it's like the BBC version of The Office. We do 6 episodes, we do another 6 episodes, and we shut it down.
Yeah.
Is there ever a moment when you think, okay, this is great. I mean, it's terrific. I think we might be done.
I mean, if you catch me at a certain moment in the process, there are many of those moments where I'm like, forget this. Why would I do this to me? You know what? It can't be that important that we have to work this hard for it. It's just it feels sometimes unjustifiable. But, you know, those are just little tiny moments in a long stream of moments. And broadly, if you averaged out the stream, I feel so damn lucky to do this. I just feel like, you know, I mean, like, what is our job? Our job is to talk to people and to parachute into their lives and learn these fantastically interesting things about other human beings. and to experience with them whatever it is they've gone through in a really intimate way. Because you know when you turn on the mic with somebody, it just feels like that's all that exists, you and that person for a few moments. And to get to do that as a job feels extremely lucky. It feels like I'm just a few breaks away from being a well-educated bum. But I somehow lucked into a place where I get to sit in a studio in front of this fuzzy mic and talk to people and have them tell me things that are intimate or inspiring or interesting or unnerving. That just feels like a real gift. So I balance out the moments of despair with just a sort of more existential understanding that not everybody gets to do this, and this is a real, real gift.
Jed Abumrad, co-host and producer of Radiolab, joined us today from Radiolab Studios in New York City. Jed, thank you very much for the time.
No, thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Tim Slover. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.